think it's really important to embrace this opportunity. It's a challenge, but it's also an opportunity to make things better.
Bering Sea communities band together to confront Arctic development. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, June 28th. Good evening, I'm Laurie Townsend. Also tonight, the Alaska Sea Life Center welcomes a sea lion pup.
It's just like being on cloud nine. It's the successful culmination of a lot of work.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. And by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
The U.S. House passed a bill this morning that aims to increase offshore oil and gas drilling. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, the bill has no chance in the Senate.
The House routinely brings up a similar bill to the one passed today, only to see it fester in the Senate. Before it approved the measure, the House voted down an amendment that would have banned any drilling in Bristol Bay. The bill creates a revenue-sharing system for Alaska in which the state receives 37.5% of revenues. A handful of Democrats voted for the measure, but most opposed it, arguing it rushes lease sales at the expense of necessary environmental review. Arizona Democrat Raul Grijalva is a senior member of the Natural Resources Committee. He says the bill is pure politics because the Senate will not pick up something he dubs a waste of time, and the president has promised a veto.
They're good political talking points, I think, for them, but it's really bad policy.
The Senate Energy Committee is tentatively scheduled to hold a hearing on revenue sharing July 9th. Both chambers are out next week for Independence Day. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
The United States' only heavy icebreaker will soon be back in service after a four-year, $90 million renovation. The U.S. Coast Guard Polar Star is scheduled to leave Unalaska today to undergo several weeks of ice trials in the Arctic. KUCB's Audrey Carlson toured the icebreaker and has the story.
Now, BM3 Murray, contact Cordex, BM3 Murray, zero.
The 399-foot-long Polar Star is painted bright red. Its decks are clean and shiny, and brand-new anchors rest in neatly coiled piles of chain on the prow. Ensign Paul Garcia explains that this is all the result of a massive overhaul of the ship that wrapped up in 2012.
The engines were getting replaced, the main gas turbines were getting replaced, all of our cranes, I don't know if you saw the cranes when we were walking up, those are all brand-new.
The ship also has brand new navigation equipment, new systems for lowering anchors in small boats, and a newly equipped gym and movie theater to keep the crew in good spirits during polar voyages that can last up to 6 months. The renovations are extensive and impressive, but the question still remains, does the ship actually work?
Now we need to make sure that all our equipment is functioning correctly, that we're still able to withstand the same amount of force and break the same amount of ice that we were, you know, back in the 80s.
To that end, the crew of the Polar Star will be heading up to the Arctic, where Garcia says they will perform various icebreaking maneuvers using a strategy that amounts to repeatedly beaching the ship on the ice. And since the Coast Guard hasn't had a heavy icebreaker for several years now, Garcia says that these ice tests will also be an opportunity for inexperienced crew members to get trained and qualified.
We're always going to have some growing pains, but a few weeks that we're out here should hopefully take care of those. Fall time, I think we'll be fully operational again and ready to perform any mission that the Coast Guard needs us to perform.
While the Polar Star is heading for Arctic waters this summer, it will actually be spending most of its time in service in the Antarctic, breaking channels through the ice to resupply McMurdo Research Station. In addition to this yearly mission, dubbed Operation Deep Freeze, the ship will also be available for scientific research, search and rescue and law enforcement missions, and, most importantly, maintaining a U.S. presence in Arctic waters. In Unalaska, I'm Audrey Carlson.
A consortium of 10 Arctic coastal village corporations recently formed the Bering Sea Alliance and invited Shell, ConocoPhillips, and Statoil to a meeting in the community of Wales. The Seward Peninsula village is northwest of Nome. With increased ship traffic through the Bering Strait and the prospect of offshore oil and gas development in the area, village corporation leaders want to be at the table with resource producers to discuss impacts to their region. Art Ivanov works on special projects with the Unalakleet Native Corporation. He says the Bering Sea Alliance formed to ensure the concerns of local residents are heard.
I think it's really important for the villages to really engage in the process and help set the policy as it relates to development in the Arctic.
The Bering Sea Alliance consists of 10 village corporations, including Gamble, Savunga, Unalakleet, Shishmaref, Golovin, and others. The Native corporations are pooling funds and working together to gain political influence, protect subsistence resources, and get economic benefits from development. More than 50 Wales residents attended the meeting. The three oil company representatives told them there were no exploratory or drilling plans in place for this summer. Company officials say they are holding off because of regulatory uncertainty. But residents of the Bering Strait and other coastal villages are still concerned about what is to come. Winton Weapok with the Wales Native Corporation sums up the residents' concerns.
People are concerned that all the noise and traffic, you know, could change migration routes of animals, whales, seals, walrus. And of course, you know, they're concerned about accidents, spills, shipwrecks. They're concerned about making sure on the ships and traffic boats, you know, don't dump their wastewater into the ocean.
Neither Wales nor Little Diomede have the means to deal with a possible oil spill. Wales resident Sean Komonasek explains.
We being situated right out of the strait, we don't have no infrastructure whatsoever to try and keep any type of spilled fluids from coming onto our shores. We would pretty much sit there and look at it come ashore, unless we made our own out of sealskin or something. I don't know. Still, the fact remains is that, well, number one, there is no equipment. Number two, if we did get the equipment, we were not trained on it.
The Bering Sea Alliance is still in its infancy, but Art Ivanov says he hopes it will grow over the next 5 years to facilitate training Bering Strait and Norton Sound residents on oil spill response and other services the oil companies may need.
20% of the oil reserves hydrocarbons are found in the Arctic. Development is going to occur, and I think it's really important to embrace this opportunity. It's a challenge, but it's also an opportunity to make things better.
ConocoPhillips officials say what they heard in Wales was consistent with concerns of other communities along the Chukchi Sea. Statoil's Ella Eid said that if the company decides to go forward with drilling in the Chukchi, they will work with local entities to maximize training and opportunities for jobs available during exploration. Shell did not respond to requests for an interview. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, gear restrictions on the Yukon River force residents to get creative with Kenai River dip nets.
I don't see why people are complaining. We got 800 pounds of fish in 4 hours with dip nets. It's not too bad.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Children need at least 60 minutes of physical activity each day for good health. So to help your children hit that mark, find fun ways to add more activity to their day. Go for a walk together. Sign up for events in your community. Make time to be physically active as a family. Get out and play with your kids every day. For activity ideas and tips on raising healthy kids in Alaska, visit playeveryday.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
The Alaska Sea Life Center is celebrating the birth of a stellar sea lion pup they've been anxiously awaiting. The female pup was born at 5:35 a.m. on June 20th with no complications. Both pup and mother are healthy. Marine mammal scientist Lori Palaszczuk has been working to breed stellar sea lions at the Sea Life Center for the last 3 years to learn why the population is struggling in the wild.
It's just like being on cloud nine. It's the successful culmination of a lot of work. And it's rewarding and it's exciting to see that we're going to be able to collect good science from these animals that hopefully will then be turned around to have a positive impact on the wild population. And I think that the center as a whole is excited and celebrating with us, which is, you know, just makes it exceptionally special.
This is the first successful stellar sea lion birth at the Alaska Sea Life Center and the first in captivity in North America since the 1980s. The pup, which according to industry standards won't be named until 30 days after its birth, will likely be on exhibit in a few months. An unprecedented set of new policies from Alaska's Department of Fish and Game are changing the way Yukon commercial and subsistence fishermen have been fishing for their entire lives. Some residents are using Kenai River-style dip nets for the first time and catching lots of fish. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Kyle Clayton reports.
Besides the fishermen on the lower Yukon, this may be the first time anyone has heard a Yupik fisherman releasing a king salmon back into the river. That's James Isidore and his cousin Felix Patrick, two commercial fishermen from Alakanuk, a village about 10 miles downriver of Kwikpak Fisheries in Amonik. By now, Isidore and Patrick are used to fishing restrictions, especially when it comes to king salmon. According to Alaska Fish and Game, a 1998 king population decline saw the 300,000 average king salmon run size plummet to half that. And this year, run projections, even towards the high end, are less than 150,000. There's a host of possible reasons for the dwindling king population, but no one knows for sure.
Well, they're trying to save the king, so I'm for that. So my kids and their kids can eat king someday freely.
But even so, Isidore says, the idea of not keeping even the few they're used to catching is unsettling.
There it goes. Gone.
Yupik fishermen have been relying on king salmon to feed their families for hundreds of years. Kings are larger, have an increased fat content, and provide more nutrients than other salmon species. Patrick says one good-sized king can feed his family for a week. Besides throwing back kings, they're also the first Yupiks who are forced to use dip nets, a style of fishing that departs from the traditional gill net drift fishing they're used to. With run sizes of more than a million, the target fish on the Yukon is chum salmon. Biologist and private consultant for Kwikpak Fisheries Gene Sandone was part of a research team that tested alternative fishing methods seeking to balance sustainability with industry.
We tested different areas to see if we could actually catch chum salmon with dip nets in commercial quantities.
At the same time, they wanted to find a way to catch kings without killing them, as gill nets tend to do. So they tested two sections of the lower Yukon using 2 to 4 Kenai dip nets in each boat.
And we did catch a number of chum salmon, but nothing outstanding. I think the highest rate of catch we got was 40 per hour per dip net.
They also tested beach seine gear, although it's not being used now due to high water. In January, the Alaska Board of Fish approved the new gear. Many Yukon fishermen initially resisted the method. During the first period on June 18th, only 12 commercial boats were on the water, Isidore's being one of them. Because the gear is so new, there's no right way to use it. Some fishermen anchor to the shore, and others drift perpendicular to the current. Isidore points his boat downriver and propels along a line he's plotted on his depth finder. They need to be shallow to catch, and at first it's slow going. But once he gets on track, they pull in 1, 2, and sometimes 3 fish after each dip. This results in one of the big complaints about dip nets. It takes a lot of strength to hold on to the net in the current and pull it out hundreds of times a day. But Isidore and Patrick adapted quickly.
About 20 minutes after we started.
They tied small limbs to the side of the boat and used them for leverage against the current and when they catch and pull. It's hard on the equipment. The force warps the poles and they have to turn it around each time it bows too much.
But it was harder on us than the equipment, so it's better the equipment than us. It takes off a lot of pressure.
Even though some people are still hesitant about the new restrictions, more than 140 boats are now on the river.
I don't see why people are complaining. We got 800 pounds of fish in 4 hours with dip nets. It's not too bad.
Isidore drove his boat 35 miles upriver from Amonik near a place called 10 Mile Island. They drift about a mile downriver before turning around and doing it all over again. The fishing period ends at 12 a.m., and they don't stop dipping their nets a second early.
12 o'clock.
10 seconds left, I got one last one.
Yep, one more, see? One more. Every second counts.
They brought back more than 1,000 pounds of chum salmon to the fishery. Chum is selling at 75 cents a pound. A good price now, but like restrictions across the entire YK Delta, it's bound to change. Another fact Isidore and Patrick are used to.
All those different kinds of hunting rules, fishing rules. Just got to go with it. You can be mad about it. It's not going to make any difference.
Until further notice, the gear restrictions and catch and release policy are in effect through Saturday, June 29th. In Ammonic, I'm Kyle Clayton.
Friends and family members of the man who was shot and killed by an Anchorage police officer on Monday held a vigil for him last night. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has the story.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound.
That's Tammy Joe singing, an in-law of Kenneth John, who was shot by an Anchorage police officer Monday. About 100 or so people crowded around a curbside memorial to remember the man killed in the third fatal officer-involved shooting in Anchorage this year. The police synopsis of what happened goes like this. On Monday evening, an APD officer pulled John over for a routine traffic stop near downtown. When the officer made contact with him, police say the 26-year-old got out of his SUV and approached the officer with, quote, two bladed weapons. The officer, who was by himself, fired at the driver. John was transported to a local hospital where he was later pronounced dead. But the family and friends of John, who gather to remember him, see things differently. His second cousin, Leonard James, read a scripture from the book of Jeremiah at the spot where John was killed and said it was directed toward the APD.
They do not say in their hearts, "Let us fear the Lord our God, who gives us the rain in its season."
James says he thinks John was shot on his way from visiting the memorial for his cousin, Detlef Wolf, who was also killed in an officer-involved shooting in the same area this spring. Police say Wolf pointed a gun at officers before they shot him. James says he doesn't believe the allegations against either man. Although his family is hurting, James says the deaths of the two young men are an opportunity to call for change.
This is no longer a family problem. This is a community problem. And unless the community stands up and says something about this injustice that's happening to all these victims, nothing's going to happen. These cops, they're getting paid vacations after they gun people down. Paid vacations.
At the vigil, James asked witnesses to come forward and talk with an attorney working with the family. James says the family has plans for a potlatch in John's home village of Grayling this weekend, and they're making plans for his burial. Police have released the name of the officer involved in the shooting, Christopher Simmons, a senior patrol officer and 10-year veteran of the APD. The investigation of the incident is ongoing. As with all officer-involved shootings, the case will be reviewed by the State Office of Special Prosecutions and Appeals. There have been 5 officer-involved shootings so far this year, 3 of them fatal. The department's use of force policy is under review, and changes are expected later this year. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. How do you get men to wear a life jacket when the fact is that 90% of those who die in boating accidents in Alaska are men? Well, most men won't listen to this message, but they might listen to you. So have them pledge to wear a life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. That's pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back home. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Ed Schoenfeld. This week on AK, a remote cruise. It's not often that cruise ships call in the far western Aleutian port of Adak, but earlier this month, one did just that. The 295-foot Caledonian Sky wound up in Adak after bad weather forced the ship to bypass its original destination, the uninhabited island of Attu. The unexpected visit temporarily doubled the population of the remote community and turned some ADAC residents into tourists in their own town. KUCB's Stephanie Joyce reports.
In ADAC, the arrival of a cruise ship is a big deal. Most people satisfy their curiosity just by driving past. But 10 residents, a tenth of ADAC's population, actually got a tour of the Caledonian sky.
Joel, do you want to show them around the ship?
We can go up and work ourselves down, and by then you'd be about ready in here.
End up in the bar? Would you like to see the ship, or would you rather just hang out?
See the ship?
Yes.
Got it. Let's go upstairs.
Yeah, jump and show you the ship, and then you can have a drink, and then we'll get started.
The Caledonian sky is small, fewer than 100 passengers, and it doesn't take long to see the ship. We visit the forward lounge and the aft lounge, peek into a stateroom with huge glass sliding doors and its own balcony, and admire the elaborate place settings in the dining room. The adults are impressed. But 7-year-old Adrian Diaz is more interested in a different part of the ship.
The captain's room?
The captain's room? What did you like about the captain's room?
It was big.
It was big.
The Caledonian Sky is what's known as an expedition cruise ship. It specializes in off-the-beaten-path voyages and bills itself as ideal for, quote, seafaring explorers. Despite the sideways rain, many passengers were draped over the rails as the ship pulled into ADAC, peering at shore through binoculars and camera lenses. Some even disembarked for soggy, self-guided tours of town. Marine pilot John Scheibel rode with the ship from Kamchatka to ADAC, and as we check out the outdoor deck, he impresses upon us that the passengers are definitely adventurous.
Last night we were in the middle of that, and we were going through the storm outside. We were sitting out here having dinner. It was a kick. Yeah, hanging on the table. Off we go.
Wow.
Anyways,
visitors,
you gotta
told me,
get into
English,
it and go
we
for
can
it.
Take this weather. we're British. We can take this weather.
Oh yeah, and there's some. These people are tough. They love it.
After the tour, we head to the lounge. The passengers have lots of questions about life at the end of the chain, and it quickly becomes clear that as extreme as they may be, they think people who live in ADAC are much more extreme. Cynthia Galaktianoff was one of the first people to move to ADAC after the Navy cleared out, and she enthusiastically plays the role of ambassador for the struggling community. In her opinion, ADAC just needs to be approached with the right attitude.
I talk to everyone, and one day I'm going to meet that one person. It's a billionaire that's going to say, yeah, I think we'll start a whole new, you know, a whole new business out there.
Yeah.
Because everyone who comes here is very, they love it. I mean, they do. Every single person, you know. I mean, some people have bad experiences, but not if they meet me.
It turns out all of the passengers get to meet her when she's invited to give a talk about ADAC and its history. Galaktianoff starts with the thousands of years of Unangan habitation, and then Vitus Bering's arrival, the buildup of tens of thousands of troops during World War II, and the Cold War era, when ADAC was a naval base. But afterwards, the passengers mostly have questions about what it's like to live in ADAC now.
My question is, what are the health provisions for the residents here in ADAC?
Don't get hurt, because the closest hospital is at the very, very best, with God's grace, 6 hours away. And we try to tell everyone to be very, very extra careful.
Do you have any police and fire people here?
We do have a sheriff. He's not really a sheriff. He's a city police officer. We just kind of call him the sheriff. He's from Oklahoma. He wears a cowboy hat. No kidding, really. Honest, he does. He's not really too busy, but he can be.
I saw a lot of empty houses, and there's a real estate next to the cafe.
That's how we do. So if you want to buy a house, we have lots for sale here.
Alas, there are no takers. Visiting ADAC is one thing, but living there is truly an adventure. For AK, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week, we'll go to Teller, a village on the Bering Sea, north of Nome.
My name is Dolly Kupchuk, and I work for Cork Incorporated as a tribal family coordinator. There's a few employment opportunities here for a few people, but not everybody. A lot of people here do their subsistence hunting and fishing, and that's what they mainly focus on. people are busy doing subsistence fishing for salmon and picking greens and berries, all sorts of greens that everyone picks to preserve for our winter use. We have a very beautiful landscape. People go out and about with, you know, just doing hunting and fishing, and there's rolling mountains. It's just beautiful here. A lot of people here go out camping. You'll see a lot of cabins. People go out camping to put up fish and just to enjoy their times with their families out in the country. I think this year it'll be held at the end of September, where we have numerous dance groups come to Teller to do performances. And we'll have like a Saturday for cultural day. Some people dance with very good grace, and you know, it's like a natural thing that came to them as they learn when they're children. And the songs have a lot of meaning to the dance, to each dance. There's hunting songs, berry picking songs, fishing. Every dance tells a story.
Dolly Kuczuk lives in Teller, Alaska. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Stephanie Joyce, Annie Fite, Sarah Bernard, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Ed Schoenfeld.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Audrey Carlson in Unalaska, Deanna Hacker in Nome, Kyle Clayton in Bethel, and Daisha Eaton in Anchorage. Ed Schoenfeld was our AK guest host this week. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C., and Sarah Bernard from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. As an active senior, your independence is important to you. One of the ways for you to maintain your independence is to reduce your risk of falling. A fall risk assessment can be part of your initial or annual Medicare exam. They'll ask about your vision and review your medications for possible problems. Learn ways to improve balance, strengthen muscles, and reduce hazards at home. Contact your Medicare provider for an appointment. This message in good health is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. The Alaska Nanook Commission reminds you that harassing polar bears or taking polar bears with cubs is not only illegal, but it is not part of Native traditions. Together with their management partners at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Alaska Nanook Commission has been working on developing a long-term polar bear deterrence plan to protect Alaska's villages from dangerous polar bear encounters. More at the AlaskaNanookCommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission, Alaska's people managing Alaska's resources.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.